Pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Jeff T. from San Francisco.
My name is Jeff Thorsness. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm delighted to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm delighted to be sober, and I'm grateful beyond my ability to communicate how I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous. So I don't know about you, but I was on a plane coming up here today, and I'm glad I had my sunglasses because I was just overwhelmed with gratitude for this deal. For me to be asked to come anywhere and participate in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is just astonishing to me. So I'm grateful. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd like to welcome you. And this is a hell of a group to show up at. I'll tell you, if you can't get enthusiastic and get involved in this group, then I pray for you. Okay? So this is a good place. You know, I don't know about you, but I came here with a lot of four-letter words, but help wasn't one of them. You know, my pride and my ego wouldn't allow me to say, you know, I'm scared to death. I don't know anybody here. You know, I'm too self-centered to do anything. You know, I won't reach out and say, do you need a hand with something? I mean, I'll just sit in the corner and die. So I would encourage you to find somebody maybe that's active in here or ask somebody, how do you get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous? And it's a heck of a deal. My sobriety date is December 25th, 1990, and I hope and pray that always remains my sobriety date, and that I'm always ready and willing to do whatever I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous to hang on to that. Other than today, that's the most important day of my life. And I've had some significant dates in Alcoholics Anonymous and in my life. So I don't know about you, but I was about 12 years old, 13 years old when I found the key, you know, that thing. You know, of course, I was 10, I was a little restless. 11, I was irritable. 12, I was really discontented, and I needed something. And it happened to be in the form of, and I suppose we all discover this at one time, we all discover this magical thing that happens, and maybe it's not so magical, maybe it's just one of those things where you take a few drinks and you go, whew, God, this is great. You know, this is amazing. And that was it for me. It was just like, it was the fear killer. And it was cheap red wine. It was nothing spectacular, but it was cheap red wine. Paisano means friend. And so me and my buddies, we drank that gallon of Paisano, and it was electric. I just went, wow, this is amazing. And at the age of 12 years old, I said that thought to myself. I said, you know, if alcohol makes you feel this good, why don't people drink all the time? And I proceeded down that path, because for me, it was amazing. And so, you know, I started getting in drink trouble at an early age. You know, I got in a lot of drink. I didn't know it was drink trouble, though. I just thought it was unfortunate timing. You know, so I got a lot of unfortunate timing out there. I was 13 years old and, you know, arranged for some beer at the Del Mar County Fair, where I was shilling for my uncle working the fair, and got in trouble for that, a lot of things. When I was a freshman in high school, actually, me and some buddies got together, and I was an aspiring wrestler and athlete, and we got together and we chugged a quart of Jim Beam. And then I saw some aftershave lotion in the counter, and I said, you know, that's how Hank Williams died, and it sounded pretty romantic at the time, so I took a few pops of aftershave. Jade East, nobody in here is wearing Jade East tonight, I know, I'd smell it. And so I took some JDs. I heard Aqua Velvet goes down a lot easier, but so we got sick, and I had alcohol poisoning that night. For whatever reason, I didn't die, but I was the one sick kid, and I told myself I'd never drink again. I mean, I was just brutal, and actually, I had the opportunity to go to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was a freshman in high school, but back in the 60s, AA wasn't, you know, young people in AA wasn't real prevalent public information. There wasn't a lot of outreach. And so I opted to go to continuation school. So for 6 months, you went too, huh? For 6 months, I didn't take a drink. You know, and that's about as much sobriety as I can handle is 6 months, and even at the age of 14 or 15. So the night I got, you know, went back to school, me and my buddies got together, and I did what it talks about in the third chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous, was I switched to natural wines. I switched to brandy, you know, I stopped drinking 151 and just went to regular Bacardi, you know, for a while there, and so that, I went down that path. So a lot of things kept happening, you know, drink trouble, problems at school, all that. I ended up meeting a little gal, and it looked like my athletic career was about over, so I decided to not to go back to high school my senior year. So I went to work for my father-in-law to be, and he was a plastering contractor. And, of course, they needed some hod carriers. We got any hod carriers in here? Yeah. So I was hodding for my father-in-law, and I've never met a grateful plasterer yet. You know, they're just a bunch of ungrateful bastards. No matter what you do, they always want more. And then later on, I was getting a plasterer's union to do pretty good. But I dropped out of high school with no tools, and a little while later, I was going to marry my little girl, Marcy. And some things started to happen. Now, I have no tools for living. I really don't. And I'm just scared. And, you know, it looked like the best option possible. Of course, I wanted to inherit my father-in-law's plastering company, but I don't like to work, like, all 5 days in a row. So, you know, I usually take a Wednesday or Thursday off. So after a while, just like when we do a four-step, they see a pattern in your behavior. And he nailed me out of the gate. So, but by the age of 20... there's some success mixed in there. And by the age of 19 and 20, I'm buying a home with the aid of my father-in-law. And we're living in a house, you know. And so there's some success in there. And, you know, I'm starting to feel like, but I'm drinking. You know, I don't know about you, but when I drink, I seem to drink until I lose the ability not to drink. You know, and as Marv talked about earlier, I didn't know it was the first drink, but I could just drink phenomenal amounts of liquor. And phenomenal amounts of beer. It was amazing. I think, where does it all go? And they used to talk about having a hollow leg. And, you know, the old time saying, yeah, and I know what that hollow leg is like. And, you know, a 12-pack of beer, a case of beer, and it was just amazing. But so what happened was, you know, that I got busted a couple of months before I turned 21 by the ABC board for buying alcohol. And, you know, I didn't think, it was just bad timing. You know, I had nothing to do with that. So some things started to happen, and Marcy and I got married and decided to have this little baby girl. And I always said I was going to be a wonderful father. I was going to do the right things. I was going to be fun. I was going to be a great parent. I was going to do all the things that I perceived my parents didn't do. You know, I was going to be her buddy. I was going to do these things. And what happened, you know, I'm the kind of alcoholic that goes out for a pack of cigarettes, and I don't come home for 2 or 3 days. And I'm a blackout, pass-out drinker. And sometimes I can't erase the things that I've done, and other times I just can't remember, you know. And you wake up with people you vaguely remember and places you don't know where you're at. And you know, it seemed kind of fun at the time, but deep inside, you know, you're kind of trading your soul for this thing called alcoholism. Didn't even know I had it. So what happened was my little baby girl was born. I said I was going to be a wonderful father and do all those things. And you know, then it was good. You know, it was good for a little while, and then my behavior started catching up with me, and my wife lost her sense of humor. I know it's, you know. She was pre-Al-Anon, and and I have a profound respect for the Al-Anon program, but she really lost her sense of humor. So I did one of those little, you know, she wanted a divorce, and it was so painful. I didn't know what to do, and so I was out of the house, and I was living in my Volkswagen van and living at my parents' house off and on, living with friends. And I did one of those little suicide attempts. Did anybody ever do one of those little suicide attempts? Yeah, there you go. And I know how you feel. And my plastering buddy at that time had like this huge sack of Valium, big sack of Valium. And so he gave me, I traded him some planks for 1,000 Valium or whatever. And so I ate a handful of Valium and I drank a bunch of booze, and I crawled up on the roof of my little house to die. And of course, on the way up, I called my parents to tell them to thank you for, I know it's pathetic, isn't it? You know, I called them, I said, Mom, Dad, I love you, but I got to kill myself. And and so I did that, and I crawled up on the roof to die, and it was a parapet roof, see, you know, and so they can't see, and they sent the police, and the police looked all over. It was 4 helicopters, you know, and that whole time, it goes back a few years. And then my mother had this nickname for me, and I know none of you will ever use this again, but I was born with white hair and had white hair most of my life, and so she nicknamed me Taffy at an early age. And that's cute when you're like 6 or 4 or 5, and you know, when you're in your 20s, you know, it's just, you know, and somebody from across the mall starts calling Taffy out, you know, it kind of loses its pizzazz. So it used to just drive me insane. And so, you know, my mother came around and walked around that house, and I was, you know, I could feel my life slipping through my fingers, and she yelled out my name, Taffy, Taffy, and it was just, you know, it was just brutal. So I fell off the roof, they pumped my stomach, and you know, I survived with not too much brain damage, but you know, so some things started to change. I was having a hard time staying employed, and I was just dying inside. And you know, I was walking around, and I knew just nobody knew how I felt. And I felt like such a loser, and I couldn't, you know, obviously keep a job, and my wife divorced me and all this stuff. And I just felt terrible. So, you know, I have two older brothers and a younger sister. And my oldest brother is a very, very successful attorney in San Diego. I mean, he's, you know, taught international law at Oxford University. And, I mean, he's just an amazing, brilliant mind. Obviously, I got the looks. But he was very successful. And, you know, I was kind of his little buddy there for a while. And I was always trying to get in his wallet, you know, if you want to know the truth. He was just so loaded, but he's a good guy. And so one day, he says, you know, I'm going on these horseback rides out in Wickenburg, Arizona, and Rancho, California. How'd you like to go on a horseback ride with me and 175 guys or 250 guys? And I would love to go on a horseback ride. Now, I haven't spent 10 minutes on a horse prior to that, so... We go out on these horseback rides, and they're big drunkathons. I mean, these guys drink from, you know, sunrise to midnight, and it's no holds bar drinking, and my kind of guys, you know. And so we're out there, and we're having some fun. And after seeing me, you know, struggling with life and struggling with the trades and all this, one day he said those magic words. He said, "Hey, you know, we just did some antitrust cases, and we bought some radio stations. How would you like to get in the radio business?" And I said, I would love to get in the radio business. I would love it. I mean, wouldn't you? I mean, you've been out there slopping mud around and stuff with some ungrateful bastards. I would just love to do anything other than what I'm doing. You know, that's the story of my life. I would rather be anywhere than where I am right now. So, and plus, I have executive potential. You can probably see that. You know, anybody can see that I have executive potential. So I'm out there, and I go through this 6 month radio training period. Now, the people that I'm training with actually have degrees in marketing. They have degrees in communication. I mean, these are bright, sharp radio people. And I'm like the brother of one of the owners that's fresh in out of the construction trades. And I have no ability to communicate without attacking or, you know, withdrawing or, you know, I'm just like a bull in a china shop in this office. So I'm there, and I get shipped off to this place, and 6 months of training, and then I went down to this place. And, you know, there's some success, as always in my story, because we have that alcoholic drive where we're just going to go in and figure this thing out, and pretty soon, you know, we'll figure it out, and pretty soon, you know, things are going to go well. And, you know, I found something to counteract my blackout somewhere along the line there, and it, you know, kind of, so I'm counteracting my blackouts a lot. And I'm down there, and the success was I sold the largest electronic media advertising campaign ever in Yuma, Arizona. So, yeah, I know, it's tough being a big shot in Yuma, but... So I'm down there, and I'm selling, you know, I put the north end of town, and I had this 24-hour-a-day radio campaign going, and, you know, life seems like it's doing good. But I show up wherever I go, you know, and as soon as I got to town, you know, I met her, you know, and let's just call her the nudist from this point on, but she was great. She became my real estate agent and kind of helped me move around. And when I moved down there, I'm living on the sixth hole of a golf course, and I'm selling advertising. Then at night, you know, I go party with the bikers and with the nudist and her friends, and so we're having a lot of fun down there, but deep inside, I'm dying, and I'm getting real sick, you know, and there's nobody I can tell. I mean, you don't go into the biker bar after work and say, you know, I have this deep-seated fear. Do you have a minute? Can we talk about it? I just feel inadequate today, you know. It's nobody seems to know how I feel, No, you just suck it up. You know, you just suck it up and pound them down and go do whatever it takes to survive. And so after my, meteoric rise, 6 months later, I'm living in a small trailer in between lettuce fields in Yuma, Arizona. And there's crop dusters going over at all hours of the day and night. And I'm thinking, what happened to this big radio, big shot, man? I'm dying of untreated alcoholism, and I'm seeing stuff and I'm hallucinating and I'm absolutely nuts. And there's not a single person on the face of the earth I can tell about it. So I went into the radio station one day, and I don't know how you feel about it. I don't know if you feel that there had to be some kind of power greater than you working in your life, or you wouldn't have found Alcoholics Anonymous. That happens to be my experience. I happen to believe there was something out there bigger than I was by far, or I would have never found you guys. So I go into the radio station one morning, and I steamed my clothes for about the 20th time, and kind of went in my eyes. I'd been overcompensating for a few days, and I went in, and they had some people from a treatment center there. And this is 1987. And it was my job as an advertising executive to find out about their business. So I sat down, and there's a whole list of questions. So I said, well, tell me about your business. And they said, well, we're the treatment center. And I thought, that's fascinating. And I didn't look at them the rest of the time. I just taking copious notes. And so I asked them all these questions, and then I said, okay, well, I'll call you back later today. So it was my job as a radio executive to write down the commercials. So I called them back later that day, and I said, okay, this is what I got, is I feel helpless, and I feel hopeless, and my wife divorced me. I can't keep a job, and I can't stop drinking. And they said, it's perfect. And it was actually a very easy spot to write for me. Try this. And then somebody suggested that I record that spot. And so, I did. I didn't do any radio recording prior to that. So I was driving down the street about a week or so later, and I'd been overcompensating for about a week. My voice comes out all over Yuma Valley, and it says, I feel helpless and I feel hopeless, and my wife divorced me. I can't keep a job, and I can't stop drinking. I went, oh, shit, now everybody knows. Unbelievable. I just sank down in my seat. And the synchronicity, I believe, sometimes that goes on in this universe of ours is just amazing. So somehow, through a series of events, I went back into the radio station, and the general manager said, we've had enough of your act, and they only knew the tip of the iceberg because I was doing a lot of stuff out there. We do a lot of stuff to survive out there. But he says, we're afraid we're going to lose our radio license and you got to go. And I said, well, guess what? I heard about this radio station I just put on the air a few weeks ago. And this treatment center, do I have any insurance? He said, yeah, you got some insurance. So I ended up at the same treatment center I just put on radio about 2 weeks ago. Somehow through that process, I 12-stepped myself into this treatment center. Don't ask me how that stuff happens. But how the ego catches up. And after a few days of treatment, I'm in there and I'm strutting around going, I'm the one that made you famous. That's why I have another 8 people in this treatment center. And they'd say things like, make your bed and go to group, Jeff. And So some things started to happen, though. And the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me on a Saturday night in that little treatment center. And when I say the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, it started with Bill and Bob back in 1935. And some guy came in and he carried a meeting, and I was the one that read How It Works from the book of Alcoholics Anonymous at my very first meeting in that treatment center. And he told a story, and he talked about how he felt before he took a drink. He talked about the way he drank, and then he talked about, the aftermath once he started taking a drink and all the wreckage. And I went, my God, this guy knows. I had never, ever. He was talking about stuff I couldn't even admit to myself, and this guy is sharing his story openly and honestly, and I'd never heard another person do that. And I figured, how much did they pay this guy? Come to find out, after doing it for many years, we do this thing for fun and for free. So he told his story, and it was a mind blower. And he talked about going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this guy was active. And he talked about getting involved, and he talked about doing this thing called AA. But I couldn't ask for help. I could, hey, how do you do this thing? I just sat there. So after he left, a few days later, my girlfriend picked me up, the nudist. She picked me up from, and we went out to Chinese dinner. And I ordered a Pepsi with dinner, and she said, usually get Budweiser. And I said, well, I just spent 10 days in this little joint, and I got a pretty good idea I'm not supposed to drink. And she said, well, beer's never been a problem for you. And I said, you're right. She understands me, you know, because I'll tell you this, I can only take physical sobriety so long. You know what I mean? I can just take being physically sober so long. And I tell you, after a little bit of time here, you know, one beer sounds pretty good. Just to kind of take that little sharp edge off. You know, that little thing where people look at you funny and those things, you know, people get expectations of you and things. Just enough to get rid of the guilt that's floating around my head. So I take a drink, just like Jim in the Big Book. The experiment went so well, I had another drink and another. And another. And the next 3.5 years of my life were, you know, that place where we go, and I ended up getting fired, obviously, went back to San Diego, worked on my brother's ranch. I became a ranch hand, and, you know, my brother was just always doing loving things for me, but I couldn't see it, you know, and I got in a recycling business. He had a couple ranches, and I'd recycle his stuff. I'd go sell it just out of spite, you know. just... pathetic stuff. You know, I'd sell the, you know, the aluminum irrigation pipe. And I told that story in Blythe, California one time, and those guys are farmers, and they were not pleased about selling irrigation. That stuff's like gold. But, you know, the next 3.5 years were just painful, and it was a place where I suppose we all get there, where we just can't stand to be with ourselves anymore. And, I couldn't stand my own image in the mirror, and every time I'd close my eyes, you know, I'd see my daughter in my brain, and I'd go, I can't see her. And I had a son through a different relationship, and I didn't even know what he'd look like, and I was absolutely useless, and I couldn't figure out how to get at him. You know, we talk about, you know, I was in a trap so tight I couldn't spring the trap, and I couldn't take physical sobriety, and I couldn't stand it was just that awful place. So what happened, you know, I got arrested a couple times, forgot that I'd been in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and back then in the late 80s, they used to do a lot of public information on TV, and I'd see people get on TV and talk about sobriety, you know, and what happened was, you know, I was living outside part of the time, you know, and I was trying to contract, and my idea of contracting was talking you into letting me move into your house while I work on your house, and... You know, I didn't have equipment, and I'm working out of a station wagon, and, you know, I just can't seem to get it. I don't know how people can survive in this world. So what happened after the last arrest was I was thinking about, you know, committing suicide again. I had a cousin that I used to drink with, and he put a bullet to his head, and it started looking like a pretty good option because I didn't know another way. And then so I'm sitting there one day, and I'm watching people talk about sobriety, and I thought, you know, if I don't do something now, I'm going to die. And there was a movie back then. You remember the Dead Poets Society, and they talked about carpe diem, seize the day. Today is what we got. So somehow I got up through that and started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I went in, I was approached by people that had found the solution, you know, people that had had the spiritual awakening, this change in personality sufficient enough to recover from this fatal malady, this spiritual malady we have called alcoholism. But I was greeted by people that were living in the solution. I was also greeted by people that were practicing the traditions because no particular person seemed to be in charge, but they were happy to see me. And they made a nice place, a nice meeting hall. Not this big. I don't think it was this enthusiastic, but I got the feeling. It was like, come on in. We're glad you're here. Have some coffee. Have some donuts. Glad you're here. Come on back, Jeff. Keep coming back. We're glad you're here. You know, nobody told me to come back for a long time unless it said, come back and bring our stuff when you come. But so I came to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to get a little hope. And for me, it was, you know, I just, physical sobriety would have been enough. Because it's going to take something big, man, to clear my brain up, because my thinking's really sick, and it's really twisted. You know, and I don't have a kind thing or a nice thing to say about anybody on the face of the earth. Save my little sister, you know, because she's the only one that's ever been kind to me under any conditions. So I was very twisted when I came to you in 1990. And what happened back then is you know, as I mentioned earlier, that, you know, I can't ask for help. I can't say, how do you do this thing? So I kind of muddled around meetings, and one of the things I noticed was that the people that seemed to be participating in Alcoholics Anonymous, the secretaries, the greeters, the coffee makers, they seemed to feel pretty good about themselves. You know, so I'm watching them go. And like, I'm a fringer, come late, leave early, won't pray, and then come early, you know, then I started coming, and then I'm, okay, I'll pray a little bit, and yeah, okay, if you want to hug, we're going to hug, but mostly girls, you know, and some things started to change. So, you know, I had some great opportunities early on, you know, after being around a little while. My mother was a periodic alcoholic, and didn't know that. I just know that from the perspective of a young man, that she was absolutely nuts. And I thought she was self-centered to the extreme, but she seemed to get a little relief when she drank, and some things like that. But when you're young and confused, you know, I'd been around AA a while, and I'd heard enough people talk about that, and I was able to see that my mother was a periodic alcoholic. And I was able to understand her. Nobody on the face of the earth understood her. And all of a sudden, I started to identify with my mother. And it was a beautiful thing. So I'm with her one day, watching her for the whole weekend. And my parents, my dad, and my brothers were off at a boxing match or something. And so I was able to spend the entire day with my mother and just be with her, you know. And I felt like there was some kind of connection there, finally. So I thought, this is amazing. So I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was in El Cajon, California. And I'd never been to this meeting before. And I walked in there, and my old friend Elizabeth was there. And Elizabeth was one of these people that, you know, we got sick together, real sick together, and then we went our own separate ways, and then I ran into her in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there she is, she's the coffee maker, and I immediately knew it was God's will for us to be together from that moment on. I just, and this is my reward for kind of, you know, understanding my mind, you know, it talks about in our book that all sorts of absurd ideas, you know, goes on. So I was full of absurd ideas. But I ran into Elizabeth, and I owed her $500, and I had the money. So I started paying her off, and we started to date a little bit. And pretty soon she noticed that I had untreated alcoholism. And she said, I don't date boys that don't take the steps. So I said, sign me up. I'm going to take these steps right here and now. So, you know, I was 22 months stark raving sober, and so my motives weren't really good. My motives to take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous weren't stellar, you know. And she talked about the miraculous things that this program had done in her life, and she said that the steps, you know, I was fearful of the steps, and she said, oh, they're beautiful. The release you get from taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, in her little Irish brogue, she'd say, oh, they're lovely, Jeff, you just have to do it. And so she made it attractive to me. And so what happened was I started taking the steps, and the first time I took the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous on my knees, within a few days, this biker guy is 6'9" with hair down to here and prison tats and one tooth. He said, will you be my sponsor? And I was afraid to tell him no. And so I started sponsoring Too Tall Tom, and we just jumped into the book. You know, I just knew, and I heard somewhere along the line that getting in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be the solution. So we started getting in the book and reading it together. Next thing you know, he brought a little band of convicts along, and I'm sponsoring a lot of guys. And, you know, it talks about in Bill's story that we were catapulted into the fourth dimension. And that was been my experience, because I went from hopeless and useless to, man, let me show you where this is at in the book. Let me show you where this is at. This is what I found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. My very life as an ex-problem drinker depends upon my constant thought of others, you, and how I may help meet their needs. You know, and I started taking these guys through the steps and started getting on fire with this thing. I took a fourth step of Alcoholics Anonymous and got rid of a lot of the shame and a lot of the guilt. You know, but there was still a lot floating around there. I hadn't seen my daughter in 3.5 years. You know, at 6 months of sobriety, I was reunited with my little girl, but, you know, I went up to her, and I said, I don't know where to start. You know, I brought 2 dozen yellow roses with me, and I said, I don't know where to start. You know, I was just broken up over the whole deal. More will be revealed. And so I started getting a little relief. I still had no idea what character defects were other than guilt, shame, and remorse. You know, I didn't know that the deep-seated selfishness and self-centeredness that we talk about in the book and the self-delusion, you know, boom, boom, boom. So some things started to happen. I ended up getting, you know, some other work and got shipped off to Blythe, California. My girlfriend's sponsor was the office manager for this electrician I was working for, and we weren't doing too well, so they shipped me to Blythe. I know it was a conspiracy, but I went down to Blythe and met some friends down there, Angie D and some other people, and got very active in that little group, and it eventually ended up meeting Johnny H down there, and then when that job was over, I saw Johnny H, and he sent me back to San Diego, where I was living. That's where I got sober. He said, go find this guy named Barney Morse. Barney's gone to the big meeting now. And so I had an idea who Barney was, and when I tracked him down, I said, my God, that's Barney. I mean, he was big, 6'4", about 350. He was a TV anchor man, and he really didn't care how I felt about anything, and he really didn't care what I thought about anything. But he got me involved in my home group, an old member of my home group's here, John. And so he got me involved in this home group, and some things started to happen, and I started making amends to people. I've got the steps going on here, went through the steps a few times, started getting some relief, starting to get some feeling. I'm sponsoring some guys. I'm active in a home group in La Jolla. And things are changing. I went to work for this little company and fixing espresso machines and coffee brewers, you know, and it was an entry-level job, and it was like, my God, is that all you're going to pay me? And I'd go and tell Barney, and he'd go, don't worry about it, kid. It doesn't matter how much money you make. You're going to be a service. I said, okay, you know, so I got this entry-level job, and some things started to go pretty good, and after about a year and a half, they asked me to move to Northern California. So I actually went to my sponsor and went to my grand sponsor at that time, and I said, you know, they want me to move to Northern California, and they looked at my case, and they said, well, it's probably better, the best offer you've had in a while. So I moved up there, took the third step of Alcoholics Anonymous at a deeper level, because I didn't know a single soul when I moved up there. And, you know, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, hopefully, you know, you raise your hand and say, I don't know how to do this thing. I need some help. I'm new to the area. Help me. And that's what I did. Moved to Northern California, stuck my hand up. My name is Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. I'll do anything to stay sober. What do you got? I'll do anything. And today I do that still. You know, I will do anything I have to stay around here, you here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started getting involved in H&I and such. And just before I moved to Northern California, I met my wife, Anita, and she was very active down there. And, you know, as soon as I stopped looking for her, you know, she shows up, and we did a month, we dated for a month, and then I moved up, and we did long distance dating for about a year. So after that was up, I said, come on up, we'll move up to Northern California. And so she showed up, and her sons showed up too. And I got a little one bedroom apartment, and her sons are 6'3 and 6'4 and big eaters. Big eaters, and they look like dope fiends to me, and I know what a dope fiend looks like. So what happened for me was then I heard Anita give her talk, and I said, my God, I've got Marv Barker and the Menendez boys in my house. And Jesus, unbelievable. Unbelievable. And so, you know, Anita and I were still paying off a lot of amends. You know, I had the county of San Diego, you know, $18,000 at one time. And we're doing this thing, and the boys are in and out and, you know, partying on Monday night till 4 in the morning. I know what that's like. So I got busy, and Anita moved up, and she got busy. You know, after about 4 months, we were able to put a down payment on a little condominium overlooking the ocean in Pacifica. And Pacific is just south of San Francisco, and we'd walk up there, and, you know, it was through a, you know, it was a little auction deal, and we'd literally have to pinch ourselves saying, given our history, what do people like us do to deserve living in a place like this? And it was a mind blower. And we realized, and it's always been my experience, that, you know, we just have to open our homes up to members of Alcoholics Anonymous and just do this thing. You know, it talks about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in fact, they read it in every meeting, practice these principles in all our affairs. You know, and so that's a big ticket item, you know, and I just have a fleeting nod at how to practice Alcoholics Anonymous in all my affairs, but I tell you, it's not for lack of trying. So we opened up our home to AA members and started a book study that's been going about 7 or 8 years now. And we had that book study the other, I had my book study, and there was about 18 guys last week. Anita had her book study, and she just had about 18 or 20 girls. And we're very active in the little community we're in. You know, at my company, I'm glad to see my friend Lou over here. He's a friend that came to hear me. He's non-alcoholic, but we've had a lot of fun. We worked at the same company together for several years, and he's an amazing guy. Moved over here from Croatia, I guess, or somewhere over there. Didn't know a lick of English 8 years ago, and he's a very successful businessman. You know, I wish, when I talk about Lou Skorik, he's a profound friend in my life, and he's got that willingness to do whatever it takes, man. If he was an alcoholic, he'd know how to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, because he's just a roll your sleeves up and get it done guy. So I met Lou, and a lot of people. I was put in supervisory roles, and after a couple years, they kept giving me more money, more responsibility, more money, more responsibility. And the only thing I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with, or to the workplace, is Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have any other skills. You know, I learned a little bit about the trades here and there, so I just bring AA to work. And after a few years, we sold that little condominium and we bought a little house. And right along in that time somewhere, I'm bouncing around a little bit and realized that, I've got very close to my mother. And in 1997, I was actually with her when she passed, and I felt like I was the only person I was the only one in the room when she passed. And some things, making amends to the parents long term, reestablished this relationship with my daughter, Sarah, and somewhere along the line, we had a grandson, and she got rid of that guy, and she got another guy, and they came up, and he asked for her hand in marriage. And she said to me those things I suppose every father wants to know. She said, wants to hear. She said, would you give me away at the wedding? And for me, it was a mind blower. I couldn't believe that I'd have this opportunity again, because I missed it. You know, she went from a little girl into a young woman. I wasn't there. I missed it all. And so there was a lot around that. And so I said, God, I'd be honored to give you away. So we had a little wedding, and it was down in San Diego, and there was 135 people there, and it was on a golf course, and it was in a room about as big as this, and it was, it was catered, and it was a magnificent event, and my father, and my brothers, and my sisters, and her friends, and it was just one of those days. And I don't know about you, but anymore, when Lassie comes home after, you think Lassie got smoked, and Lassie comes home, I get teary-eyed, so I'm there, and I'm at the beginning, I'm fighting back the tears, and then after we get rolling a little bit, I just let the tears flow, because here I'm walking my little baby girl down the aisle, and I know I don't deserve to do that, and then they had the father and daughter dance, and she said, I picked out the father and daughter dance. I said, what is it? She goes, I'm not going to tell you. And I said, come on, what is it? She goes, I can't tell you. And come on, what is it? She goes, I can't tell you. So it was a little song. It was a country western song called My Baby Girl. So we're out there, and they say it's the father and daughter dance. And we go out and embrace. And it says, from the first time that I held you. My memory just went boom. From the first time I held my little baby girl to, the first Christmas and the Halloweens and the Christmas and the Halloween, and then things started getting difficult and, kind of boom, right up to that very moment when I had my daughter Sarah, and I lost it and she lost it. And then a cameraman came up and took that exact shot. And I know that very moment to be God's grace. And there was 135 people in that room that were able to experience that moment and that had tears in their eyes. And it was just an amazing moment, because I felt for the most part that the slate was clean. I've tried to be there for my daughter on a regular basis. We just talked today before I came up here, and sometimes she just calls and I call. She's in San Diego, and we have an unbelievable relationship. And it's the full responsibility lies to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I've learned how to just be there. I never judge my daughter. I never weigh in on any opinion on what she does or doesn't do in her life. If she asks, I'll share my experience. Well, kid, I don't know. This has been my experience. But I just try to be there and just be there for her. So we danced and we cried, and 135 people had tears in their eyes. And it was a magnificent time. And my little granddaughter was born a couple years later. And You know, it was that time when some guy, you know, I told my daughter we'd be there. It was a cesarean section, and some guy blew up a transmitting tower somewhere, and all the planes were locked up. Couldn't get a plane out of San Francisco. Couldn't get a plane out of Oakland. No planes allowed. And it was like 8 o'clock at night, and we're saying, my God, we got to be there in the morning. What do we do? So we got, like, the last rental car there. You know, the whole thing just seemed to work. You know, it was just like the last car. And we got in the car, and we drove down. I did what I was taught to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, is just show up. Go to any lengths to get down there. So later that morning, I'm holding my little baby granddaughter in my arms. And it's a beautiful sight, and it's an amazing thing to be a part of their lives. A lot of things have happened in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, a few months ago, about a year ago or so, my father had a stroke. And, you know, I went to my sponsor and I said, what do I do? And my sponsor said, he said, just be the best son you can possibly be. And through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was all said. We said it. I was able to, the last time I visited him was probably the middle of March. And I went down there and he'd had a stroke. You know, we sat and we visited for about an hour and a half, and we seemed to be able to understand. I was able to understand everything he said, and he was able to understand. The thing that he remembered most was sobriety. You know, he said, I sure am proud of you. You know, I said, it's been 16 years, Dad, since I had a drink. And towards the end, you know, the very end of my drinking career, he wouldn't give me $5, you know, because he'd know what I'd do with it. Or he'd reluctantly give me $5. So my family has had the great privilege in experiencing the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happening in my life. And they're very grateful for that. I'll tell you, it's an amazing thing. So when my dad passed at the end of March, it all been said. There was nothing left that needed to be said. There were no more amends to make. I feel like the slate was as clean as it could possibly get. And it was very moving. We gave him a grand send-off. We had bagpipes, and I mean, it was a beautiful day. So what it's like right now, I've already told you about what it's like right now, a lot of it. You know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, tens of thousands of dollars in debts, unemployable. I had holes in my arms and a broken soul when I came to you, and people said, come on back. You're welcome here, kid. You know, today I've been reunited with my family. I'm a responsible, productive member of society. I pay taxes, do all that stuff, you know, for lame people, for the square people out there. I do all that stuff happily. I'm very active in a home group. It's a second tradition group. Have had great examples of sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous. Phenomenal examples. It's my responsibility to try to keep up with my sponsor. I sponsor a lot of guys, and it's their job to try to keep up with me. And thus far, there's a pack of slackers. I'll tell you, I have some great sponsees, and you know they're going through the stuff right now. They go through divorces and deaths, and you know the life happens here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I made a lot of mistakes here, but I haven't made the fatal mistake. For me, it's a fatal mistake. I haven't made the fatal mistake of taking one Budweiser. I haven't had the fatal mistake of taking one little glass of wine or one little glass of champagne. Because for me, the kind of drinker I am, you know, there is no fun left in the bottle. So a lot of things have happened. We own this new home in a little town called El Sobrani. It's right across in the East Bay, and our home is always welcome to members of Alcoholics Anonymous. The company I work for has given me far more responsibility than I could have ever imagined. I mean, they give me the responsibility of spending $12 or $14 million a year for them. Relatively unmarked. I mean, not unmarked, but... Yeah, the unmarked stuff's the easiest, but, you know, there's some checks and balances in there, but I tell you, you know, how things like that happen. You know, so if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I just wish that you just go, you know, how can I do this, you know? Just maybe you do this after the meeting, but is there a raise of hand of people in here who's willing to sponsor? You know, have a look around. There's a lot of help in this room. You know, and it all starts with, how do you do this? Can we get together and read this book, man? Because the Alcoholics and the book of Alcoholics Anonymous has described me to me. It's described me to you and all the other behaviors out there. So I'll tell you this, is that, you know, my daughter is grateful. My grandchildren are grateful. I called my daughter up tonight, told her I was coming up here, and I said, I'm going to tell her story again. And she says, oh, good. And I've given a talk with my daughter in the room. I've given a talk with my father in the room. And you got to watch how much of your story you tell with your with certain parts of your family. But, you know, I suppose my neighbors are grateful that I'm sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. I know the police are grateful that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I know my employer is very grateful, and my boss knows that I do this thing called AA. You know, and right now, there's four of us in my particular department, and three of them have degrees in architecture, and I'm the guy that's kind of the stumble bum off the streets, and I'm up for senior project manager. How's that work? I mean, these are college-educated people, and all I do is show up and say, you know, my name is Jeff, I'm an alcoholic, I'll do anything to stay sober, or boss, what do you got for me today? You know, and we get out in the trenches and we do this thing. And, you know, I'm not always, you know, yesterday and today, there was probably two people that couldn't say, well, there goes a spiritual guy. But there were some other people in the workplace. I mean, sometimes you got to have hard conversations in the workplace, but Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to treat other people with respect and dignity and to hold my head up as a sober member of AA. So most of all, I want to thank you for the life you've given me. It is beyond what I could have ever imagined for myself. God bless you.